Welcome back, folks. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia, back for another segment of American Warrior, right here on 104.1 KQTH. Listen, you know, we usually start off with a day in history, and I've got a couple things that you will find very interesting, particularly if you're a regular American Warrior listener. On this date, in 1773, the British Parliament passed something they called the Tea Act, a bill that was designed to save the faltering East India Tea Company by greatly lowering its tea tax, in effect granting it a monopoly for the American tea trade. As you probably know, that led Sam Adams to organize a little party called the famous Boston Tea Party after Parliament passed that act in 1773. In 1805, after marching 500 miles from Egypt, U.S. agent William Eaton led a small force of U.S. Marines and Berber mercenaries against the Tripolitan port city of Derna. Now, that may sound familiar because if you've heard the phrase to the shores of Tripoli in the famous Marine Corps hymn, that's where it originated. Lieutenant Presley O'Bannon, who was commanding the Marines, performed so heroically in the battle that Hemet Kamali presented him with an elaborately designed sword that now serves as the pattern for all the swords that are issued to Marine officers. That famous phrase from the Marine hymn started on this date in 1805. Folks, as you may know, I attended the U of A. I won't say when. Well, I guess I'll have to. But in 1983, a group of friends and I got together at his small apartment to watch a TV movie called The Day After. And I tell you, it was that the movie was about the effects of a nuclear war in a small Midwestern town. And there was a scene in the movie where the residents of this small town go outside and they see all these missiles leaving their silos, going up on their way to targets, probably in the Soviet Union. And I tell you what, I'll never forget, after we finished watching that show, we all went outside. It was eerily quiet, and it was just absolutely chilling. And what was particularly chilling for us is because we knew at the time, and many of you who are listening, and maybe some of you who are listening don't know this, but at that time, that scene could very well have been to Tucson. From 1963 to 1987, the crews of our United States Air Force stood 24-hour alerts at 18 Titan II missile silos that ringed our community. Each silo was capable of delivering a 9-megaton nuclear warhead to targets several thousand miles away. For many years, Tucson was on the top of the list, I think near the top of the list, for a Soviet missile strike, not only because of Davis-Monthan, but because of those 18 missile silos that surrounded Tucson. Today we're joined by a woman here live in studio who stood that watch, one of the first women selected for duty in the Titan II missile program, and she served also as the missile crew commander and trainer during the Cold War. She now serves as the executive director of the Arizona Aerospace Foundation, which you may know oversees our wonderful and famous Pima Aaron Space Museum. So, Yvonne Morris, welcome to American Warrior, and thank you for your service.
Well, thank you, Ben, and thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today.
I got to tell you, Yvonne, I don't know, and you probably see this on your duties out there at the Air and Space Museum and your work with Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm finding, though, that that time in Tucson when those silos were all around our community seems just like yesterday to me. But as much as our population here in Tucson changes, I suspect there's a lot of folks here who had no idea that at some point in time we were at the top of that. You know, we talk about top 10 list. That was not a top 10 list, or even a top 50 list or a top 100 list that Tucson wanted to be on.
Well, that's entirely true, Ben. I think it's more and more it's difficult for the museum to provide that perspective for the younger generation that's coming through. We're having to give more and more background every day about the Cold War so that people can put what they're about to see when they visit the Titan Missile Museum so that they can put that in context. And that's really our job. Our mission has evolved over the years at the museum from just preserving and presenting the story of the Titan II to taking care of a national historic landmark and to providing that context for people and then to give them a frame of reference that they can use when they're thinking about and when they're going to contribute to the discussion about the future of nuclear forces in America.
Now, what I say it was on the top of the list, is that, and there may be, like many of my guests, there's things where you'll say, no, Ben, I can't talk about that, it's still classified. But do we have any idea of what was Tucson, a top 10 target, a top 50 target? Suffice to say, we're at the top of the list?
It's pretty well known that Tucson was probably in the top 10 for the former Soviet Union and their targets, and that's for a number of reasons. You have the 309th AMARG at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, largest military aircraft disposition center, storage and disposition center in the world. Then you had Fort Huachuco, which is the communications center for the Army for the Southwest. And then you had 18 missile sites ringing Tucson. So it made Tucson a very likely target.
Now, Yvonne, before we get too much into that specific story, tell me, you were one of the first women selected to crew the Titan II or to serve in that program. What were you from? How on earth did you... I mean, that's quite an achievement, but let's back up even further. What inspired you or motivated you to join the Air Force in the first place?
Well, what motivated me to join the Air Force, I was in college at the University of Virginia at the time, and I was about to run out of money. I was putting myself through school, and I attended a sort of a welcome party for a friend of mine who had joined ROTC and found that it appealed to me, and so I thought that I would give ROTC a shot. I have this problem that I've never been able to figure out really what I wanted to be when I grow up.
I still have that problem.
Yeah, and so the Air Force seemed it would provide an opportunity for me to do something that was not routine, and I was looking for that. And so once I joined Air Force ROTC, between your second and third years of college, you actually go in the summer, you actually go on active duty for 30 days. And they call it summer camp, and all of us cadets called it summer cramp. And I was sent to McConnell Air Force Base in Wichita, Kansas, which was home of one of the other Titan II wings.
I tell you, Yvonne, hold that thought right there. We've got to take a quick commercial break. We'll come back because that's interesting. You mentioned that Wichita really was one of those other locations. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior. Stay tuned. Great guest, a woman who was directly involved in the Cold War. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior 104.1 KQTH. We're joined by Yvonne Morris, who actually was involved in, you know, a period of history that Tucsonans don't think about much anymore, the Cold War, but Tucson was right in the thick of it. We had 18 missile silos that ringed our community, all poised to deliver a strike that thankfully never happened, standing watch on orders that never happened. And Vonna, I apologize, I interrupted you. We're talking about how you first got involved in the program. You'd mentioned ROTC, and you spent some time in Wichita, which was one of the other sites of the Titan program.
Right, Ben. That McConnell Air Force Base was also surrounded by 18 Titan II missile sites, and the goal of the summer program for ROTC cadets is to give them an experience, a real-world experience with the Air Force. So we toured a number of units on the base, and that included the opportunity to tour an operational Titan II site. And I was very impressed by that. It seemed to be, it was a job that was out of the ordinary. It had a lot of responsibility. It offered young officers the chance for an early command. And so that appealed to me. And that was in 1978, and that was the same time that the Air Force was opening that career field, the Titan II career field, to women for the first time.
Right at that point where you
saw
it.
Right at that point.
Oh, interesting.
And I did very well at summer camp and finished number one in my flight. And when I got back to the University of Virginia, there was a recruiter who came to talk to me and who told me that, you know, we're opening the Titan II career field to women, and would you be interested in that? Mm-hmm. And if you would be interested in that, we're willing to give you a full ride scholarship for the last 2 years of college. That's pretty much what sealed the deal.
Okay.
And so But in 1978, they were also taking women who were already on active duty and transitioning them into the Titan II career field. So I'm one of the women who was selected early on, but mm-hmm. women had actually been in that career field for about 2 years before I came on active duty.
Now, we talk about Tucson, we talk about Wichita. How many sites were there around the country, Titan II sites? There was not that many of it, as I recall.
No, we're big, but a small unit. There were 54 Titan II silos mm-hmm. around the United States. You had 18 around Tucson, 18 around Wichita, Kansas, and another 18 around Little Rock, Arkansas.
Now, do you know why those sites were selected?
You know, those sites were selected. There are a lot of criteria that plays into that. Some of it is still classified, mm-hmm. but some of it that we've been able to surmise just by looking at what they have in common is that the missile sites needed to be near an Air Force base that was large enough to support it logistically. That base had to be serviced by a large railroad line so that you could bring in the components for the Titan II. And then there were population issues that also, they were looking for areas that weren't largely populated. And so the middle of the United States is commonly referred to as the missile fields of the United States. It was the least populated area at the time. I'm talking North Dakota, Montana, mm-hmm. all the way south to Arizona. And that's largely where the United States focused its intercontinental ballistic missile bases.
So the range of these missiles, is that classified? What is the...
No, the range of the missiles is about 5,500 miles to 6,000 miles. We would be able from Arizona to hit any target in the former Soviet Union that was
so
necessary.
That the range of the missile really wasn't... I mean, you can pretty much shoot it anywhere,
yes,
I guess, as long as you're going
yes.
in the right direction. Now, what one of the things that fascinated me, and I told you this story when we had the crew of the USS Tucson. On occasion, we get those sailors here to Tucson. And on one occasion, we had them. We took them down to visit the Titan Missile Museum, and the fellow conducting the tour had been on duty at that particular museum. So that spurred a lot of interesting direct questions. And a little, he talked about going on high alert, or basically where they had to seal up. They closed everything up, nobody in, nobody out. And one of the young ladies on the tour said, well, what's the longest you ever had to be sealed up down? He said, well, one time it was almost 72 hours. Well, the sailors kind of snickered a little bit, and we had to apologize afterwards and explain to them, well, you know, these guys are buttoned up for 60 days at a time. 72 hours didn't seem like that much. But which when you came on duty, was once you graduated or were prepared, whatever the term is, were you assigned right then to Davis-Monthan? Or
when I came on active duty, I first went to Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls, Texas, and that's where all the folks who served in the Titan II system went to ground school.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I actually got to crawl around in the guts of the missile that's on display at the Titan Missile Museum.
That very missile. Oh, how cool is that?
And then from there, we went out to Vandenberg Air Force Base to learn the complex ways that the missile is launched, the really classified portion of our mission. And then from there, you report directly to the wing that you're going to be assigned to. And for me, that was Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. And then once you get to the base where you're going to be permanently assigned, you go through another 6 weeks of what they called upgrade training, which really puts the fine points and the conclusion on your training.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start going on alert.
And what, as they're selecting, as a civilian, and probably most of the folks listening out there, we see the movies and, you know, all these sorts of things. I mean, your finger is on the button. There's a key in the button. And what, I assume the Air Force wasn't just taking anybody. You had to be a certain type of person to be qualified and to be passed to allow access to that. I mean, literally the ultimate weapon that we had at the time.
Right. Well, there wasn't a particular background that the Air Force was looking for. We had a rocket, but it wasn't rocket science for us.
I like that. That's good.
The Air Force was looking for motivated, stable,
mm-hmm.
professional people who were intelligent, who were capable of thinking out of the box, but who would only do that when you needed them to think out of the box, and who would not be become bored by the routine that was necessarily built into the system. Once you were selected academically, then you went through a psychological screening. Everybody in the Titan II system was monitored under something called the Personnel Reliability Program. And basically the goal of that program is to find out, Ben, if we were given the order to launch the missile, would we be able to do that? We were treated by the flight surgeons on the base. I couldn't see civilian doctors. If I was going to have surgery of any kind, a flight surgeon had to be present because we couldn't be put under anesthesia. We couldn't be hypnotized because of the knowledge that we had. So we couldn't go downtown to the circus and volunteer to be the one to be hypnotized and cluck like a chicken.
Well, so, I think that speaks to that. You know, I think about, and one thing I want to talk about a little bit later on in the show really is what is that life like? Because service in the military is one thing to begin with. But to be those little things that I would never think about, like, okay, you can't go under anesthesia. I mean, that's a pretty big deal.
It is a big deal. And, but once you got used to it, I mean, the Air Force had a very good system. The flight surgeons on base, it's easy to see him at that time. And so after, it took a very short amount of time for the whole process to really be second nature.
Now, Tucson was in that whole program of those, I think you said 54 sites that you mentioned. If I'm not mistaken, Yvonne, Tucson, the first missile squadron to actually be activated to achieve operational status was right here at Davis-Monthan on June 8th, 1963, the 570th Strategic Missile.
Yes, part of the 390th Strategic Missile Wing that was based at, here at Davis-Monthan. All 54 of the Titan II sites were constructed in basically 28 months. I mean, from the time that they broke ground on the first missile site, it was a 24-hour-a-day operation for 28 months until it was done. So the last Titan II missile site actually became operational in December of 1963, and that's when they declared all three units operational and ready to stand alert.
Yvonne, we've got just a couple of minutes before the break. Explain to our listeners, though, particularly for the young people who might be listening, what was the concept, the philosophy of the Titan II program? Again, it's one of those weapons you want to have that you never want to use. Was that the deterrent?
Right.
Basically, the deterrent concept.
What most people are very surprised to find out about the Titan II is that it was a retaliatory weapon and that the actual mission of the Titan II was peace, peace through deterrence. Our job was to be a credible threat, to demonstrate to the former Soviet Union that even if they launched a surprise first strike against the United States, that we would be able to ride that out. We'd be able to retaliate with such devastation that it would be basically committing suicide for them, and thus we would deter World War III from ever actually happening.
And at that point in history, it really was the Soviet Union, or I should say the former Soviet Union. We didn't have any other...
That was the former Soviet Union was the principal threat, yes.
No backpack nukes or anything like that to worry about.
Not so much.
Not so much. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about what, really get into that, what, you know, the kind of the day in the life of a missile crew. What the crew itself at each missile silo was how many persons on a shift?
We had four members on each crew. You had two officers and two enlisted personnel. You had the officers were the missile combat crew commander. That was me. Mm-hmm. And then the other officer was the deputy missile combat crew commander, and they're basically a crew commander in training. And then your two enlisted personnel had different expertise. One of them was an expert on how the missile operated, and the other was an expert on all the ground support equipment of the actual missile site.
Now, those two officers, you were the two that actually would have stuck the key in the console and pushed the button.
Yes, it would be the two officers that would initiate launch sequence.
Amazing, amazing. Fascinating stuff. Folks, we're right here live on American Warrior. Give us a call if you'd like, 751-1041. This is your host, Ben Bueller-Garcia. I'm joined by Yvonne Morris, former missile crew commander. We'll be right back after this short break.
those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now back to the American Warrior on 104.1 The Truth.
We're back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, live here on American Warrior. We're joined by Yvonne Morris, who's the executive director of the Arizona Aerospace Foundation. But more importantly to today's topic, she actually was a missile crew commander that staffed and was on duty at one of the, or several maybe, of the 18 Titan II missile sites that ringed Tucson once upon a time. Just an amazing, amazing part of history, of the Cold War history. And she was right there in the thick of it. If you've ever wanted to talk with someone who literally had their finger on the button, if I may say that, Yvonne, give us a call, 751-1041. We're live in the studio. Now, Yvonne, coming back, we talked a little bit about the crews and the number of crew members. Briefly described, were you always, well, two questions. Were you always assigned to the same silo? And did you always have the same, did they try and match those same four crew members together all the time? Or go ahead.
Well, I'm going to answer the second question first, okay, because that sort of leads into the answer to the second question. So, yes, crew integrity was very important to the overall function of the Titan II system, especially under the PRP program, mm-hmm, because the personnel reliability program wouldn't work, or it would work its best when everyone involved knew each other. As a crew commander, my job was to know my crew very well, to know what they liked, what they didn't like, what behavior for them was unusual, what behavior was typical. For example, let's say that one of my enlisted folks always complained when we had to go on alert on Sunday because that meant that they missed church. Mm-hmm. And church was very important to them. And so as soon as we possibly could, after we got all our duties done, when we got to the site, we would allow this enlisted person some time for Bible study because that was very important to them, and we respected that. Well, let's say that, I don't know, 6 months later, we noticed that he stopped complaining about the fact that we're on alert on Sunday. Mm. And this person who never drank or never talked about going out with his buddies to go drinking, all of a sudden starts talking about, you know, hey, I went downtown last night, had a really great time, had a few beers, it was great. Well, that's a very drastic change in this young person's behavior. And as their crew commander, I need to resolve that. I need to understand what's happening there, because the goal of the PRP program is to make sure that our head's in the game and that we're capable of doing our job at all times. And so someone who makes a life change like that, it can often be triggered by something that can impede their ability to do their job.
Now, that at that point in time, your job, and thankfully you never had to execute the ultimate part of your job, but your job was to launch a nuclear strike on the Soviet Union or some other target. Period.
That was one part of our job. We actually had two jobs while we're out at the missile site. The first part of our job is called readiness monitoring, and it's our job to monitor the entire missile site, the condition of the missile, the functioning of all the equipment, and make sure that the missile is ready to launch if we receive that order.
So, and that's important. So you guys didn't just go down there and sit around and drink a milkshake and wait for the order to come. You were busy all the time doing maintenance and prep.
Yes, we were busy all the time. We didn't actually perform the maintenance, but our job was at least twice in a 24-hour alert cycle, we would inspect all of the equipment on the missile site. And the first time that you do that, it's very detailed, and you're mm-hmm. taking a lot of notes, and you're just looking at every single piece of equipment, and that takes about 5 hours. And then the second time that you would do it mid-shift, you're looking at a few key points, you're sort of stopping on every level of the silo, you're listening as much as you're looking, because you're listening for any noise that sounds mm-hmm. out of place that might indicate that a belt is coming loose or on a piece of equipment or anything like that. And so our job in the maintenance aspect was to be able to identify malfunctions and then be able to, using the tech data that we had at the missile site, to isolate the malfunction to what was called an end item. We're going to use troubleshooting diagrams that are basically going to lead us through a process of discovery. And at the end of the discovery process, it's going to say something like, replace this widget.
Okay. Now, when you come on to your shift, when you report to the silo, then the previous crew commander has to turn over the silo to you and notifies you if there's anything you need to be aware of, or was that a formal transition sort of thing, or it's like,
yes,
hi Bob, hi Yvonne, have a nice day, see you later?
No, the Air Force had a checklist for everything in Titan II duty, and so this was the crew changeover checklist, and so the offgoing crew commander would actually lead both crews through the crew changeover checklist, and it would include a briefing about any notable maintenance activities from the prior day, any existing conditions that they thought we should know about, any maintenance that was scheduled for the oncoming day of which they were aware. And then the last part of that is the offgoing officers would take their locks off of the emergency war order safe or the EWO safe where the keys were stored. And then we would open that safe. The oncoming officers would confirm that the launch keys are in there, and then they would close the safe, and then we would affix our locks onto the safe. Hopefully that's where they're going to stay for the rest of the day.
I tell you, you were trained well, Yvonne, because just as we're talking here in the studio, you still, because I noticed you watching me doing things like playing with my pen cap. I'm thinking, is she looking at, am I capable of launching that missile? What? Very briefly, we've got about 4 minutes before the next break. I got to geek out here just a little bit. Walk us through what actually happened. Phone rings. Let's say if you were to go to that point where you had to prepare to literally launch that Titan II missile, walk our listeners through what those steps would be.
Well, these things are always going to happen in the middle of the night, you know. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to have to make sure that the one officer who's sleeping at that time we're going to wake him up. We're going to get both officers down in the launch control center. And
well, let's back up. Does a phone ring? Does a light go on?
Actually, what will happen is what we would have heard is, and we call it a warble tone.
Okay.
And it's kind of like this deedle, 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 deedle kind of noise. And that alerts the crew that we have an incoming communication of some kind. And so the two officers are each going to take their stations, and then they're going to wait for the SAC controller to begin to read the message. And so what the crew's going to hear after that is a set of, well, the first thing they're going to hear is called the preamble, and it's going to be something like, for missile site 571-7, for missile site 571-7, this is a yo-yo message in 6 parts. Okay, that's called the preamble. From that preamble, you get 2 pieces of information. You get the missile site that the message is addressed to, so it's missile site 571-7, and you get a yo-yo message. So let's just say that in our world, a yo-yo message is a launch order. So the two officers will then open up their emergency action message copybooks to the launch order. The preamble is going to be repeated a number of times, and then at the end of the preamble, when the controller is actually going to start reading the actual message, he's going to say message follows. And from that point on, the crew commander and the deputy crew commander know that they have to write down every single thing that they're going to hear after that. And what they're going to hear after that is a series of alphanumeric characters. Whiskey, Alpha, Bravo, Echo, Tango, Charlie, Foxtrot. That's not a code. The message is actually broadcast in the clear. What gives each of those characters meaning is where they fall in the format of the launch order that they're copying. And so the crew is going to get a number of pieces of information from the launch order. They're going to get something called an authentication code that's going to allow them to confirm that the message is actually from the National Command Authority. They're going to get a code that unlocks the butterfly valve lock on the Stage 1 engine. That was our fail-safe device to prevent the unauthorized launch of the missile. If that pre-valve isn't open, then propellant isn't going to flow into the Stage 1 engine, so the missile is not going to launch.
Yeah.
So we're going to get that code that's going to unlock that. And then the third piece of information that we're going to get is the launch reference time, and then the two officers will use that to compute their actual launch time. And then their launch time, both officers will turn the keys. And for your listeners who have been to the museum, they will know that where you expect a lot of noise and a lot of whistles and bells going off, it's really eerily silent.
It's creepy. It is.
The entire launch sequence is 58 seconds long, and it has exactly two noises in it. You've got a little alarm that goes off in the middle, and that's the first one. It always makes people jump because they're so intent. And that alarm bell is to the security system topside. It gives us additional confirmation that the silo closure door over the launch duct has started to open. And then about 20 seconds later, you get this big klaxon, and the missile's gone.
Wow. Well, it's just giving me chills thinking about it. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. I want you to think about it over the break. How close did you ever come to that? Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by a missile commander, Yvonne Morris, who's executive director of Arizona Aerospace Foundation, talking about the Cold War and the Titan missiles. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. One more segment left. If you have a question, give us a call, 751-1041.
My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. Till the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. If you want to support them, start with WoundedWarriorProject.org. Now, back to the American Warrior on 104.1 The Truth.
And
we
lit up your... And we're back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I got to tell you, Yvonne, I've had Colonel Cole, who was General Doolittle's co-pilot, on the show. I've had Gary Sinise on the show. I honestly this is not the chill up my leg, but this is just chilling. I mean, just talking to you and knowing that you were there. You were going through just describing to us that kind of that sequence of events that would lead up to your mission. And it's interesting. We've got a caller. Jose has a call about your mission. Jose, you're on the air with Yvonne Morris. What's your question?
Yvonne, first, thank you for your service. And my question is basically, how do you feel about never having had the chance to carry out the task that you were training to do? Does it feel weird never having to have accomplished it? Or and not to say that you feel sad about never, killing people, but just doing that one task, just pushing the button that was so important. How do you feel about never getting to do that?
Well, actually, Jose, I feel like I did accomplish the task that I was trained for, because the Titan II was a retaliatory weapon, and our goal was, and our mission was, peace through deterrence. And if we had ever actually launched our missile, then it would be because our primary mission had failed. So I feel like I accomplished my mission, and for that reason, I don't regret that I never launched a Titan II. And then the other reason I don't regret it is that, unfortunately, we wouldn't be here having this conversation today.
I don't regret you never launching either.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too. You actually did your mission, because I'm talking to you on the phone right now. So
yes.
Thank you again for your service.
Excellent
you,
way
Jose.
To put it. Jose, thanks for your call to American Warrior. Yvonne, coming back to that, we've got a few minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about the dynamics of that. You've got four people. You're literally locked, well, not locked, but you're in this relatively small space with a very, very important mission. And you've got to be on all the time. What was your rank at that time?
I was a lowly first lieutenant.
So you were a first, wow. Amazing. Well, no, I mean.
Yeah.
Just as a civilian, I would think that you'd have, wow, okay, I'll leave it at that. What is, from a management perspective, you're responsible for that crew and making sure you're prepared to fulfill the mission. Talk a little bit about the burden of command. If, I don't know if that's the right phrase, or how did you see that? Was it just another day at work for you?
Well, first of all, never underestimate the motivational capability of chocolate chip cookies. And I learned that.
There it is, folks. Write that one down. Lesson to be learned right here on American Warrior.
You know, crew commanders in the Titan II system, we were blessed with airmen who worked with us who had been vetted by the same process that we had been vetted under. And on the whole, I found them motivated and disciplined and ready to do their job. And so really, as a crew commander, the day-to-day mission, it was kind of a dream scenario for a young person to, for someone who'd had one other job in her adult life before this, to, between the training that the Air Force gave me and then just the level of service and that the Air Force demanded, because in the Titan II system, there was very little room for error.
Sure.
And so we spent a lot of time training, a lot of time just going over the processes. And because crew integrity was so important to the successful function of the system, that's one of the reasons that the crews functioned well together. And I never really found it necessary to discipline any of my crew members. I mean, sure, everybody wants to blow off steam every once in a while, or they want to sleep a little longer when it's time for them to get up, or their uniform could have been a little bit more pressed when they came to work. But when the rubber met the road, these guys, they were there. They were all there. They were ready to do their job.
Now, before we went to the commercial break, I asked you about the question, did you ever have to get that close? And you told me off the air, no, Ben, can't answer that, not going to answer it. So I didn't want to, you know, I teased the listeners a little bit. Folks, answer is not forthcoming. It's one of those wonderful classified things we get here on American Warrior. But if people want to see what it was like, they can visit the Titan Missile Museum just south of us in Green Valley. What are the days, hours of operation, days of the week where folks, I cannot emphasize this enough, folks. If you get a chance, if you have visitors from out of town, go down and visit this museum. It is literally a piece of history.
Well, the Titan Missile Museum is open every day of the year except for Thanksgiving and Christmas from 8:45 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon. Tours begin at 9 o'clock and run all day. And the last tour of the day begins at 4 o'clock. So I always want to advise people to never wait for the 4 o'clock tour if you can avoid it, because only 25 people can go on each tour because we can't fit any more than that underground. And you don't want to drive all the way down there at 4 o'clock and find out that the tour's full. So always try to come earlier in the day, and especially as we get into the summer, I encourage people to come for those 9 and 10 o'clock tours.
Sure.
We're going to get underground really fast, but there's still a couple minutes out in the blazing sun. And once you're there, we're going to take you underground to the Launch Control Center, and you're going to learn a little bit about crew life, and then you're going to get to go through a simulated launch sequence, which, thanks to the folks at Raytheon, we're able to take you through the experience. They helped us wire the simulator so that we can give you the exact experience. And then we're going to take you out into the missile silo and show you the missile.
Wonderful. We have a caller. Chris is calling to talk to Yvonne. Chris, what's your question for Yvonne Morris, former missile commander?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question is two parts. One is, how long would you be able to survive in the silo after a war? And then after everything is destroyed, what would you do next? What would be the next steps for you as the crew? What would you guys do after everything was blown up?
Interesting. Interesting questions. Chris, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Those are very interesting questions, Chris. And the answer is twofold. First of all, the crew had 30 days of emergency rations on site, and theoretically enough air in the control center that we could survive for 30 days underground while we waited to see what would happen next. Basically, what the crew was supposed to do is launch their missile and then go through something that was called the post-launch checklist, which we'd use that to help us put out the fires in the launch duct, get the site buttoned back up. And then essentially the last step of that checklist is await further orders. And that's the real kicker, because In a scenario where you're using the Titan II, there weren't very many of us who actually thought that there would be any orders forthcoming. Because one of the first targets, of course, is your command and control. So higher headquarters is probably wiped off the map. And it's really going to be up to the crew commander to lead their crew through what's going to happen next. And that, Ben, was actually one of the biggest burdens for me of my command, because we didn't receive any training for that. There were no radiation suits. There were no Geiger counters. We didn't even have any transportation, and the transportation wouldn't have worked anyway, because one of the things that happens when you detonate a thermonuclear weapon is you get this electromagnetic pulse that mm-hmm. fries mm-hmm. all the electronics, so the battery on whatever car you had is dead, not to mention the tires are probably melted. So, but we didn't really think about that very much, because frankly, I don't know anybody that really thought that they were going to live 30 minutes past getting the launch order, because that was the thing about the former Soviet Union and the United States. We both had enough nuclear weapons to wipe the countries off the world multiple times over. Every missile site that the United States had was targeted by multiple Soviet missiles, because one of the things, you can't be a credible threat or a deterrent if you're not out there in the open saying, I exist. And so the former Soviet Union knew where all of the Titan II missile sites were. We were targeted multiple right. times over. So every crew member I knew, except for one, was just hoping we'd all live long enough to actually launch our missile. And the one guy that I knew said he had a Jeep in the desert. He was going to launch his missile and book for Mexico.
Colossal Cave. Stash up there. He was good to go.
I kind of think they were just prolonging the inevitable. So, theoretically, we could survive for 30 days. We were going for 30 minutes.
Wow. Wow, again, that's chilling. That truly is truly, truly chilling. Yvonne, thank you so much for your service to our country. Anything else you'd like to share towards? I obviously encourage people to come visit the Titan Missile Museum. Now, is that the only silo? We talked a little bit off the air how disappointed I was, because I happened to be in Tucson when they deactivated those silos, and I was expecting a big boom, and it was just kind of a little thud. But is the Titan II Missile Museum the only remaining silo that the public can visit?
Yes, the Titan Missile Museum is the only remaining Titan II site that's intact. If you go up to Catalina, there's a Methodist church that's built on a former Titan II mm-hmm. site. There's a nursery on a site. I think it's out in Avra Valley. There's a fitness center built. I mean, what happened is the sites were decommissioned, and then the land was sold through GSA. So a lot of ordinary people own Titan II missile sites that have been imploded now.
And this is all possible with the Arizona Aerospace Foundation. If people want to look you guys up on the web, where do they go?
TitanMissileMuseum.org and our other museum, PimaAirAndSpace.org.
Wonderful. Yvonne, again, thank you for your service to our country. Thanks for being on American Warrior.
Thanks.
Wonderful, wonderful interview. Hey, folks, have you ever wondered what it takes to be absolutely the best in the world at what you do? Stick around. On Daily Mail, we'll be talking with Chrissy Parham, who held the world record for swimming and has won several Olympic gold medals. Folks, if you want to see, if you missed a show, you want to share the show, direct people to 1041.com. 1041, what is it now? KQTH, Jim.com. All the shows are archived there. You can listen to them in the convenience of your own time and home. This has been your host, Ben Bueller-Garcia. Thank you so much for tuning in. Stick around. We'll